Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is music journalist Mark Masters, and we're talking about his new book, High Bias, The Distorted History of the Cassette Tape. Mark, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
I have to admit, I have a huge, and we don't have these anymore, those special things that held numbers of cassettes. I have a big one of those in a closet filled with my personal mixtapes, all with original cover art. So when I saw this book, I knew I was going to love it. What brought you to write this history?
Well, I like you, I grew up at the time when mixtapes were big and a lot of different cassettes were just the big thing when I was a kid. And so I was always interested in them, always a fan. I've held on to them my whole life. And I was always interested in and how the whole thing got started. But then also the fact that there's been a little bit of a resurgence of use of cassettes, especially by small bands and labels who don't have the money to put out vinyl or vinyl's taking too long to make and it's easier to make cassettes. And they're finding some of the same unique qualities of cassettes that we did when we were growing up. So I thought this was kind of a perfect time to look at both ends of that and see how they connect, see what made cassettes so unique and why they've sort of hung on, despite the fact that a lot of people don't know that they have.
But what really brought me to this book, and I enjoyed it so immensely, is the way that you wrote about cassettes, even in the introduction. You called them, quote, always felt a bit forbidden, revolutionary, small, cheap, and easy to use. And that was really true. And that made them, and then this is in your own words, personal, amateur, and subjective. It was literally an audio medium made for everyone. And that's something I never even thought about. I just did it.
Right. Oh, yeah, it's the same here. Yeah, I don't think I really thought when I was a kid taping records from friends or making mixtapes that I was doing anything particularly revolutionary. But I do remember feeling the sense that, like, maybe someone doesn't want me to be doing this, that added to the kind of the fun aspect of it. And it turned out it was true. I mean, the record industry was unhappy about the fact that people like me were sitting at home taping friends' records and not going out and buying them. So it turned out that there was something sort of, radical about it.
We're going to talk about that in just a second, but I got to check with you. Whenever I had a mishap where a lot of the tape came out and I had to rewind it, I always used a Bic pen stuck in the sprocket hole. Did you?
Yep, I did the same. I used to use a pencil that I was sticking the hole.
Same deal. It's like octagonal. It had to have those edges. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's funny. There's a current company selling cassette players, new cassette players, and it comes with a little pencil.
Excellent. I love that. Before we go any further, we should talk about the title of your book, High Bias. What does that mean?
Well, the technical term is a quality issue term with blank tapes. It's a process that makes them sound better. But I kind of like the double meaning of it because in two senses. Number one, there's sort of a bias to anybody writing a book about cassettes because they were so personal and so related to your own experience that there was no way I could make it a fully objective book. It's biased by my own perspective on growing up with them. And then also, cassettes really kind of biased or distorted the industry. They changed things so much that they put their own kind of weird stamp on things that's still there,
And originally, the tapes themselves were not high bias. They were sort of low bias. I mean, that was part of the whole attraction. I won't say attraction, that's too strong a word. But one of the things you accepted about cassettes is it was a little bit wonky, the recording quality. And that was part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was a trade-off that was worth it to most people because the fact that you were getting this freedom to tape things yourself and make whatever kind of tape you wanted to make as opposed to just having to listen to what's on the record or what's on the radio. I mean, I think most people took that trade. And musicians did, too. A lot of musicians were like, we don't mind taping our, recording our music in such low quality because we're getting to do it for cheap. We don't have to pay to go into a studio, and it's totally worth it to us.
Now, when did the first cassettes come out?
It was about 1963 or so. That's when
I was surprised it was that early because I didn't connect up until them into the 70s.
Yeah, and I don't think they really caught on until later 60s, earlier 70s. But the person who invented it, Lou Ottens from the Belgian company or the company in the Netherlands called Philips, he first sort of debuted them and the player at a conference in 1963. So, yeah, they've technically been around 60 years now.
Now, when they were invented and the public was made aware of them, it was probably not to tape music. What was it? What were the original sort of uses viewed for this?
Yeah, that's correct. The Ottens and other people on his team who invented it figured that the quality wasn't high enough that people were going to want to listen to music on them. So they assumed that it would be for voice recordings, memos, letters, voice letters to people, journalists using them to take notes, or people in any kind of field work who needed to record any audio. I think that's what a prime idea. And of course, a lot of musicians immediately saw them and said, we don't care about that. We just love the fact that it's so cheap.
And I have to admit, the first cassette I got, I was taping things off the radio. You know?
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and I had a real cheap recorder and stuff like that. What I was surprised about from your book is how early on cassettes were demonized. You write about a panic in the mid-60s?
Mm-hmm.
Can talk about that.
You mean the home taping is killing music panic?
Yeah.
So that's the name of the kind of advertising campaign that a British recording industry did, the home taping is killing music. The industry was panicked the fact that they realized people were using these blank tapes to tape each other's records and rather than go buy them. And they freaked out and thought, we're losing all this money because of this. We got to do something about it. But unfortunately, one of their big tactics was to tell everybody to stop doing it, which is not a very effective way to go about it.
Just say no. just say no, Mark.
Exactly. In fact, of course, we were talking before about how it seems so rebellious. I mean, that added to it. I think a lot of people, myself included, probably thought this is such a cool thing to do. They don't want us doing this. A man doesn't think we should do this. But eventually they became to accept it because I think they realized it was helping too. You know, if I tape a record from a friend, maybe I'll go buy another record from that band if I like it.
So it had no effect. All these things of like just say no just didn't matter.
No, those never work.
Did anybody else have any other way of thinking that they could deal with it?
They did try other things. They tried to, in many countries, tried to put a tax on blank tapes, and it actually happened in a few places. But again, that was like, how do you distribute the money? It just was kind of complicated. Plus, a lot of people weren't necessarily using tapes for their own music or for other purposes. So it seemed a little unfair to tax those people when it didn't have anything to do with taping music. So nothing really ever caught on, in terms of, and nothing ever slowed it down, of course. I mean, blank tapes just sold more and more and more over the 70s and 80s.
Now, you mentioned 8-tracks just a bit, but it's not really, mm-hmm. that's not the history. But I started thinking, sure. Was the 8-track the way of them trying to control the cassette? Because you couldn't open it up. You couldn't do anything with it. You couldn't overtape it. You couldn't do anything.
Right. Yeah, I think so.
You know,
think
and Mark, I have to ask you, because the audience probably does not remember 8-tracks, but can you explain what they were?
Yeah, so they're a cartridge, maybe double the size of a cassette tape, that you suck in a different kind of player, and it was all contained like a cassette tape's contained, but it was a little wonkier in terms of how to use it. Like it had eight tracks of audio rather than the two and four that are on cassettes. So it technically sounded better. I think that's the reason that they brought it in, hoping that people would think, oh, these sound so much better than cassettes. These are what I want. But they were definitely harder to record on, and they were weirder to play. They had these weird sets of, you know, songs would be divided into four, and I barely remember how to use them.
I still have like one or two, but from the very beginning, I thought that was just really not, this is not going to work.
Yeah. No, I think they were trying to market them as things to put in your car, too, but cassettes worked fine that way as well. So.
Yeah, there was a period of time when cars actually had 8-track players in them.
That's right. Yeah. That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's get back to the cassette. One of the other things that is I learned from your book is the evolution of the player for the cassette was critical to the history of music.
For sure.
And one of the things was the evolution and growth of speakers, and that eventually led to the boombox. Can you trace that?
Yeah. So essentially, when the cassette first came out, it was considered the first decks that they were made for were basically handheld, portable, recordable decks. That was basically what they thought people were going to use it for. They didn't necessarily imagine that people would listen to the music straight out of the cassette, but Philips eventually did develop a player that had speakers incorporated into it, assuming that maybe somebody might be interested in that. Of course, and people were. In fact, especially in Japan, where Sony took that design and ran with it, and it became what people think of now as the boombox, basically a portable, but much bigger than the portable cassette player, a portable player that had two large speakers on each side of the cassette deck. And it became huge in Japan and then quickly huge in America, especially in New York. It was like a street cred kind of thing. If you had the biggest, loudest, coolest-looking boombox, was one of the coolest things in New York, especially in the early hip-hop scene.
It's amazing because those boomboxes, for people who don't remember them, made it into as important symbols in movies like Say Anything and Do the Right Thing.
Yeah. They
were like featured on boomboxes, the two huge scenes in those movies. Yeah. I still have my old boombox. I don't use it. But I can remember they were so big, and people walking down with them, like holding it on one shoulder, was just an amazing thing to see. And they were bringing the music out into the neighborhood.
Yeah, and it was great in some senses. I mean, some neighborhoods, people I'm sure loved it. But on the Do the Right Thing is a great example of how also it was controversial, like walking around telling everybody, you got to listen to what I'm playing right now. And I mean, that's the main conflict in that movie comes from that very fact.
Yeah, you likened it to a sonic campfire. I love that. Now, talk about how cassettes and boomboxes, but cassettes especially, advanced the popularity of hip hop.
Yeah, well, hip hop initially started as a kind of a party music with DJs making break beats between two turntables before even anybody was rapping over top of it. It was the back of the music that they would eventually rap over top was what came first. And this music only really happened at parties on streets or in nightclubs and things. And the only way you could hear that if you weren't there is if somebody taped it. And eventually the DJs figured out that so many people were taping these and circulating them, they can do it themselves and sell them on the street. And not, so some DJs made their living doing that, which was part of what helped hip hop grow. But the biggest thing was that these tapes getting passed around meant the styles of these different DJs were just circulating so quickly and mutating so fast. And a DJ would have a party on a Friday night and then go see someone on Sunday and see that person doing what he had done on Friday because the person had heard a tape from his show. Yeah.
Well, that's so that just.
This brings made it up, develop outside of mainstream circles too. Anyway, I'm sorry.
This brings up that people were able to copy cassettes.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me. I know that they eventually did this. They would put out cassette players that had two places for two cassettes,
right?
And you could copy cassettes pretty successfully. And therefore, if somebody recorded some hip hop artist, they could make their own copies and sell them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, some of these DJs would go home after their sets and just sit with their double tape decks, all stay up all night and make as many copies as they could so they could sell them the next morning on the street. And those double decks were a big thing. I mean, I remember as a kid, I tried to wire together two cassette decks, and sometimes it worked and sometimes it wouldn't. But when those double decks came out, I'm like, well, I don't even have to be here. I just press play and record on both of them, and it just does it itself. It's pretty amazing.
Well, the other problem with that is that at that time, major albums by professional artists were being released on cassette. So if you bought one, you could make your own copies.
Oh, yeah. Yep, and sometimes, in some cases, the blank cassettes were actually better quality in terms of sturdiness than the cassettes of these pre-recorded cassettes that were being sold. So you're actually making almost a better copy than what you bought.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is music journalist Mark Masters. And we're talking about his new book, High Bias, The Distorted History of the Cassette Tape. It's funny because, cassette players went big, but they also went small. Talk about the invention of the Walkman.
Yeah, so this was an invention by some of the executives at Sony that decided they wanted to have they already had a thing called I think it was called the Pressman, that was like a handheld recorder that they were marketing, but they thought, instead of just for recording, let's put some headphones on it, which seems like the most obvious thing, but up until that, it hadn't happened. And that took off almost immediately, too, especially once it made its way back to America. People were, once they called it the Walkman and they were selling it for a reasonable price that anybody could buy, everybody in the world had one.
Yeah,
it started as a status symbol first until it got reasonably priced enough. But and that was a big revolution in terms of being able to have your own kind of personal music with you all the time outside of your house, and be also sort of be cut off from where you're making a soundtrack to your general walking around in your existence, but it's not anything that anybody else is hearing. I think some kids, you know, like my kids now who listen to their music that way all the time, probably can't even imagine what it was like before that. But before that, you couldn't just walk around with your own music collection, you know.
I know, they have it so easy today.
They really do, don't they?
What was the Tascam M144? It was a four-track.
Yeah, so it took advantage of the fact that there really are four tracks on each cassette, two stereo pairs, one on side A and one on side B. And this invention of a tape recorder that could actually record different information on every one of those tracks was used by musicians to make sort of multi-track recording, which up until then had only been a thing that happened in really expensive studios. So you could, like, sing on track one, play your guitar in track two, play drums in track three, and mix them relative to each other. So one was louder, one was softer. You could mix all those down to a track and keep adding other instruments. And that was a big thing, especially for independent artists who, you know, just were never going to find a way to get into studios otherwise. They just didn't have the money or the connections to big record labels or things like that. And, you know, a lot of musicians ended up not just recording their demos, but actually recording things that end up coming out. I mean, even Bruce Springsteen recorded an album on one.
Now, there was so much that I learned in your book, too, that I just didn't know. I mean, everybody can imagine all this going in New York City. Mm-hmm. But it was happening in other places like Houston, Texas.
Yeah.
And there were different, there was really wild and phrases to describe the music that I'd never heard of before. What are pause tapes?
Okay, so pause tapes are sort of a similar to mixtapes, but they were kind of a bigger thing in hip hop, where instead of DJing the music back and forth and making beats that way, some of these DJs or just hip hop fans and makers would make tapes by hitting, you know, they record one tape to another, hit pause, record it again, unpause, back and forth between different sources to make sort of a DJ mix. Using that capability of the cassette, the fact that it could so quickly stop and start became the kind of the aesthetic for how they made their mixtapes.
But there are other terms like go-go music and screwed music.
Yeah. Yes. So, I mean, go-go was really the music of D.C., which is the area I grew up in the 70s and 80s.
So there was that specific sound of D.C.?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so how would you talk about that? How would you distinguish that? What makes go-go music?
Go-go, it's got similarities to hip-hop, but it's very oriented around live drumming, live beats, and it's kind of a call-and-response type of music. A beat gets going, and the band sings, and they start directing the crowd to sing back and forth, and that's kind of the essence of go-go, essentially. It mutated in many different forms, though, especially because the cassettes, it really got around on cassette. It didn't really ever become a big genre that came out on records a lot, but bands would take their shows, or fans would take the shows of bands and trade them. And there were even stores in DC where you could go and say, I really liked that Rare Essence show the other day. Could you have it? And they'd be able to dub it on the tape for you can buy it from them right there.
Wow. And what was screwed music?
So Screwed is based around a figure named DJ Screw, who was in Houston. And he was a DJ sort of simultaneous with the rise of hip hop in New York, but he kind of came up with this idea of, rather than speeding everything up or making it as fast mix as he could, he was going to slow music down.
Wow.
It had this weird kind of wavy underwater quality that's really kind of hypnotic.
Go ahead.
No way, I'm just going to say. And he did this all on turntables, but he would tape them all and sell the tapes. And he got so popular in Houston that people were lining up outside of his house. Only come at a certain time because the cops think I'm a drug dealer because they're lining up outside of my house.
Now, just talking about all these different forms of music means that cassettes are really important documents for the history of the music. Mm-hmm. Like, people need to be preserving these cassettes, or at least preserving the sounds that are on these cassettes. Are people doing that?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there is a time period, especially when cassettes were so prominent, that some people only put their music out on cassette, especially internationally in the non-Western countries. There were certain kinds of music that just wasn't deemed acceptable by the mainstream or by the state or by the record companies that only circulated around on cassette. So it only exists still that way. And there definitely are people working very hard to preserve all that, both here and abroad. And I have a chapter in the book about people who actually just take trips specifically to other countries just to try to dig up as many cassettes as they can. And partially because they want to find music they love, but also because they realize that this is, you know, they're kind of saving this music.
I know, what a great chapter that was. I love that. Now, it's not just disco and hip hop and dance music, but heavy metal and punk. And you talk about heavy metal, like people were really considering this unfiltered, unsanctioned when it appeared on a cassette.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of early heavy metal circulated on cassette among fans more than it did on records that record companies put out. But metal fans really quickly figured out that this is kind of a subculture that we could connect with each other through these fanzines that people were coming out, magazines about metal that people were putting out, and they'd have sections in the back of Pen Pals things. Of course, they had to have cooler names than that, so one of them was called Pen Bangers. But they would write each other and say, hey, I'm looking for this Iron Maiden show, or I really want to hear, I love Iron Maiden, do you have anybody else like that? And they would trade tapes, and eventually the bands caught on that, you know, this was a good way to get their music circulated if they got it into this little mini ecosystem of people trading tapes. I mean, that's how Metallica got their
start, couldn't
really get on a label, so they put their tape into this circle of people, and it got around really fast.
What's ROIR?
So ROIR was a Reach Out International Records, which for some reason they wanted it pronounced Roar, even though it looks like Rower. But so that's a label that was in New York in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. One of the first sort of tape-only labels, one of the first labels that said, we're just going to put things out on cassette, because that was still kind of a radical idea back then. And they put out a lot of the independent punk and new wave music from New York out on cassette. And they took advantage of the fact that some of these bands who already were on labels didn't have anything in their contract about they couldn't put a tape out on some other label. They could only put vinyl out on the main label they were on. So this label put out a lot of the kind of the pioneering punk on cassette only, and some of the best stuff from that time period.
Like the New York Dolls and Suicide.
New York Dolls and Suicide, yeah, Television, yep. Richard Hell, a lot of really cool stuff.
Now, on the other coast, Sub Pop started out as a fanzine or a magazine, right? That periodically would issue cassettes.
That's right. Yep. Yeah, I mean, basically, it was not a record label first. It was a magazine, and Bruce Pavitt, the guy who started it, really liked the idea of sort of doing a magazine on cassette as a way to spread music around to people rather than just describing it in print. And you actually could hear what they were talking about. And he also loved this idea of sort of regional scenes, so he would try to get bands from different little pockets around the country of good local music scenes and get them on these Sub Pop compilations. And once those kind of took off, he realized, well, maybe I could make a record label. And
wow.
You know, the rest is history. He found Nirvana and they became huge.
Now let's talk about today. With films like Guardians of the Galaxy, cassettes suddenly became part of the public conversation again. And yeah. I love the fact that when they issued the soundtracks to the first two movies, they were made to look like a cassette. But are cassettes still being made and people still buying them?
They are. Yes, they are. There's a sort of a network of underground labels that make more experimental, you know, either rock or electronic music that found that it's just cheap, like it used to be, cheaper, easier, faster to put things out on cassette. Vinyl is so expensive now, and it takes so long. The pressing plants are all so backed up. And you can make a cassette in a few days for just a couple bucks per copy. And so it's a way to sort of sell their music on something physical, because there is an audience out there that still wants physical music. And even if they don't necessarily have a tape player, they want to buy something from the label to support them, you know, because streaming is so hard to support a band or a label that way. And it's so much easier to get the money to them directly by buying something off of them from Bandcamp or from their own website. And so, yeah, there are a lot of labels putting out cassettes, and I think they're really being creative with it too. It's some of the most interesting looking cassettes with all different colors and different artwork. And
yeah.
I think it's a really neat scene.
I want to mention that you do have photographs in the book, and some of the photographs of that artwork on those labels are fantastic.
Oh, yeah, they're very creative.
Now, is the problem finding a cassette player? Like, you can make a cassette, but what are you playing it on?
Yeah, that is a bit of a problem. I mean, there are still people making kind of knockoffs of Walkman and those kind of work, but they're a little cheap and they break pretty easily. They're still high-end decks that audiophiles can get, but a lot of people can't really afford those. The mid-range is tough. The kind of deck that you and I probably used to have, a component deck with either two cassette players or one in it, those are harder and harder to find.
You can't get a cassette playing boombox anymore, can you?
I think there's a few, but it's pretty rare. You know, and of course, a lot of, you know, Goodwills and used stores have these cassette decks, but you never know exactly if those are going to work or not.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, so it is an issue. But, you know, with a lot of the new labels, a lot of people will buy the cassette, and even if they can't play it, they'll download the music and at least feel like they had something tangible that they got to support the band they're into.
And we're almost out of time, but I want to mention, you have a great chapter on mixtapes. And I'm one of those people that used to make, you know, find somebody I was interested in and go, let me make you a mixtape like John Cusack does in High Fidelity. But there are so many other ways that people made mixtapes. It was really a way to communicate with another person, not just romantically or hopefully romantically, but to let them know who you are by your music tastes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, they were personal expression in a lot of ways, both in what music you put on them and how you decorated them, how you listed the music. But, you know, what music you juxtaposed with other music, what kind of flow it had, what you put on one side or the other side, those were all kind of personal statements and also, you know, ways to share tastes in a much more tangible way than just saying, hey, I'm into this band. You actually get to hear the stuff that I'm into. And like you said, the communication ranged. I think the cliche is it's about making it for somebody you're interested in dating, but it ranged a lot farther than that. Sometimes it was about saying, hey, I know you like these bands. I think you'll like these
bands.
Right,
right, right.
Or it could even be a sort of like, hey, look at these records I have that you don't have.
Sort of gloating over the rarities that you found. Well, that
exactly.
was big back in the day, too, that you would be the first person to find that band in your neighborhood and listen to them.
Sure.
As soon as everybody else was listening to them, you no longer listened to them.
Right.
Are there stores that sell cassettes?
With the resurgence of vinyl and the fact that record stores are kind of on a comeback trail right now, there are stores that have cassettes in them. I mean, it usually is a small section in the back or to the side, but there are a couple stores. I focus on one great store in L.A. called Jackknife that's almost 50% cassettes. They have these huge racks of cassettes on their wall, and they seem to do fine. So it's really fun to go look through those. It's really a sort of a trip down memory lane to be able to walk in and see all those cassettes on the wall.
We're out of time. My guest tonight has been music journalist Mark Masters, and we've been talking about his book, High Bias: The Distorted History of the Cassette Tape. Mark, it's been a real pleasure.
Same here. Thanks so much for having me on.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.